Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'd like to thank the organizers of the workshop for inviting me to that, and ITP for hosting my visit for the past week. Today's my last day here. In fact, when I was invited, I was supposed to give a talk at the workshop last Friday, and then the intention was that I would give an informal talk to a small group of people, close friends and family, about very recent and unpublished work. So then I heard that that was converted to a colloquium, but I'm going to talk about, at least partly, about new and unpublished work. So Federal Express was working overtime the last few days. The title of my talk is New Frontiers in the Control of Matter with Light, and I thought for a colloquium it's nice to give somewhat of a historical perspective. So I looked a little bit into the origins of that topic, and the earliest paper that I found was by, well, didn't actually find the paper, but it's a book by Kepler from 1619, in which he explained the direction of the tails of comets due to radiation pressure. I don't think he called it that, but due to the effects of light. And that, as far as I know, is the earliest prediction. Of course, there was nothing quantitative. The first quantitative predictions were by Maxwell, and
that was based on just observation.
Just observation, that's right, that they were pointing away from the sun, that's right. The predictions of radiation pressure due to Maxwell stimulated experiments, and the first experiment was by Sir William Crookes in 1873. And he built a device which is now called a solar engine or a light mill. You can order these from Edmund Scientific if you want. So yesterday's hard experiments are today's toys, which is kind of depressing. Anyway, he did an experiment in which he had a rotating rod with vanes on it, four vanes, and each vane was painted on one side with black, and then the other side was silvered. And the idea would be that because of light, the silver part would reflect, the black part would absorb, and there should be preferential radiation pressure on the silver side, because there you get a reversal of direction, whereas in the absorption you just get absorbing of light. So he did the experiment and submitted this for publication, and it was sent out to referees. One of the referees was Maxwell. And Maxwell apparently was delighted to see this, because this was, you know, the first experiment confirming radiation pressure, which he had predicted. So he recommended publication, apparently it was published. But then it turned out the embarrassing fact was that the thing rotated, but it rotated in the wrong direction. And it turned out to be an artifact of, which is actually a very complicated explanation. I think Reynolds was the one who finally explained it from the Reynolds number. But the point is that there was effects due to the absorption and heating of air and so forth. But the conclusive experiments were only done in 1901, so it took almost a quarter century to do that by Lebedev and then by Nichols and Hull, and exactly 100 years ago. And those really, in some sense, were the first quantitative experiments on radiation pressure of light. Then, to move on, so another landmark was a prediction by Kapitsa and Dirac from 1933. They wrote a paper in which they predicted that if one sent a beam of electrons through a standing wave of light, you could see diffraction of electrons. So this was a reversal of the role of light and matter, that you'd have diffraction of matter off light. And they actually put in some numbers. Kapitsa was actually an experimentalist, so maybe he was the one who put in the numbers using available light sources at the time, and they found that the probability of diffraction was 10 to the minus 14. So they concluded that this was just on the verge of feasibility. And now it took, just this year actually, a few months ago, an article in Nature appeared in which they actually have seen this effect conclusively, just as originally proposed. So one moral for this is be careful when you make predictions for experimentalists. Now, let me go from a historical perspective to describe a sort of unified picture of matter-light interactions. And the strongest interaction that we can have is when we are on resonance with an atom. And this actually apparently was realized already by Lebedev 100 years ago. So in some sense, that is the precursor for all laser cooling. The simplest atom you could think of is a two-level atom. It'll ground in an excited state, and if you are exactly on resonance, you'll be dominated by absorption to the upper state, followed by decay. And clearly that's enhanced very much by the process of resonance absorption. If you are, instead of being right on resonance, if you are near resonance, at, let's say you are detuned some detuning delta, you could either be, in the case of an atom, you can either be detuned red to the transition or to the blue. And in one case, you get an effect. In both cases, it turns out that the probability of absorption is extremely small, can be made small. And if, in fact, the dominant process is just a shift of the ground state, and that shift is proportional to intensity divided by detuning. And note that the sign of the detuning actually determines the sign of the energy shift. So in the case of a red detuned light, that shifts, that minimizes the energy when you go into the light, so it's therefore attractive, and that's the basis of the optical tweezer, whereas if you're blue detuned, that's repulsive, so you're pushed away from the light. Now, of course, you can go all the way to the extreme of non-resonant interaction, and this would be what you would get if you just applied an electric field, a static electric field. You have some static polarizability alpha, and the energy shift is just proportional to alpha times I. Now, you can imagine applying this to different particles, starting from electrons, atoms, molecules, nanoparticles, cells, and on up. And they have varying degrees of difficulty or ease, depending on their structure. So atoms have an advantage that they have a resonance. Electrons are hard, as I pointed out. They have no resonance that we can easily access at low energies. Atoms have a convenient resonance. Once you get to larger particles, you start to be helped by the fact that the polarizability scales with the number of particles or with the volume, so large particles are more polarizable. And then there's just no man's land of objects like molecules that are non-resonant, but also too small to be affected, to be helped by that fact. And that is, in some sense, the toughest nut to crack, but I'll come back to that. So what are some of the milestones in manipulation of matter with light? I think one of the early ones, perhaps it's not given enough credit, but I think it was really quite important, was the invention of the optical tweezers by Ashkin, because that was, to my mind, the first real manipulation of matter with light, with laser light. And he showed that you could actually, in his first paper in 1970, he could take and move around polystyrene beads. And that has had enormous applications in biological sciences. But other things which you're more familiar with, perhaps laser cooling and trapping, ultra-fast coherent control, and Bose-Einstein condensation, have all been important. So the question is, what are the new frontiers? And now, this is a highly subjective topic. And so what I'm going to state are what I think are my frontiers. They may not be your frontiers. Everyone has their own frontiers. Here's an example of someone's possible frontiers in laser manipulation. This is, you can't read this, long-range laser surgery. And it says zap and ouch here. So, but my choice, and that's what I'll talk about today, are topics that I think are important and we can now start to address using lasers to manipulate matter and to control matter in interesting ways. And so let me start from how this is sort of the short list of things that I'm interested in. First one is the interplay between nonlinear dynamics and quantum mechanics. This, in a sense, is the borderline between quantum and classical in regimes where you have nonlinear dynamics, as sometimes people call this quantum chaos. We have been interested in this topic for some time. A second topic is many-body quantum control. In some sense, you could view that as an application of Bose-Einstein condensation. Now, we've gotten beyond the stage where we can make condensates. What can we do with them? How are they going to be used? So I would call that, and if they're going to be used in novel ways, in some way, we should be taking advantage of the many-body nature and not just the fact that they are ultra-cold. Another big challenge, I think, is to be able to cool and trap and control atoms and molecules in general. So despite the big success of laser cooling and trapping, it really has been limited to a very small set. You can almost count it on one or two hands, the number of atoms that you can laser cool, because the basic laser cooling requires a two-level transition. You have to have a ground and excited state. You have to go up to the excited state, but back to the same state. That rules out most atoms in the periodic table and all molecules. And so there's this big field, which includes all of chemistry, which has been just not been affected to a large extent by cooling and trapping. And the question is why, and can we do anything about it? I don't think I'll actually have time to talk about this. It's a really interesting topic, but it might take me a whole hour. Also, we're in the midst of working on this. We don't have really new results yet to report. The final topic, which I'm intrigued by, is the possibility of controlling biological processes with light, and I'll try to make that clear. So to be specific, and the topics that I will focus on here, are recent work in my group on these frontiers. In the context of nonlinear dynamics and quantum mechanics, I will talk about a new type of trap, which we call the optical billiard for atoms. On the many-body quantum control, I'll talk about a theory that we've developed recently to make a quantum tweezers for atoms, one at a time or two at a time, an exact number on demand. Coulomb trapping, we are working on coherent slowing of supersonic beams and stochastic cooling. And controlling biological processes, we've done recently in experiments, we've been able to show control growth of neurons with light. So I'll hope to explain all those in more detail as we go on. So let me start from the first topic. That is the interface between nonlinear dynamics and quantum mechanics. This has been of interest in my group for the last 8 years or so. We've been working on experiments with ultra-cold atoms, and I talked on last Friday about some of our recent experiments on chaos-assisted tunneling. And some of our earlier work is reviewed in these articles in Physics Today, so you can read popular reviews. But today, I will focus on a new system that we've been working on in the past year, and one that I think is particularly well-suited to the combination of many-body effects and new physics. The problem that I'm going to consider is the one of a billiard. A billiard is a two-dimensional structure with closed walls in which I have particle motion that's confined within the walls, and I'm going to assume that we have just ballistic free motion and elastic collisions off the wall. So that would be the picture of a classical billiard. And perhaps you know or have heard that the dynamics, classical dynamics of a particle, depend strongly on the shape of the billiard. So for example, in a circular billiard, you get stable periodic orbits, whereas in a stadium, what I've drawn here, you get chaotic trajectories. And this has been the topic of a lot of work in experimentally, in condensed matter physics, experiments with quantum dots, shaped in the form of billiards, and electromagnetic analogies with microwaves. So, but we decided to revisit this from our standpoint of ultra-cold atoms, and we established this type of trap, which we call a billiard. This is a trap by design, as opposed to typical traps that people have worked with in the past tend to be harmonic. But we want to explore traps that explicitly are as anharmonic as you can get, in fact, maximally chaotic. And the idea is the following. So first of all, to confine atoms in two dimensions, we hold them in a standing wave of light. So this is just made of two counterpropagating beams of light, creating nodes and antinodes. And if you remember my first transparency, or the one about the optical dipole forces, remember that you either had attractive or repulsive forces. With an optical lattice, if you're tuned to the red, the particle will be trapped at the antinodes of the standing wave. If you're trapped on the blue side, it'll be trapped at the nodes. But in any case, it'll be trapped. However, in this case, we tune intentionally to the blue side. And then what we do is we create a closed spatial pattern using blue detuned light. The idea is I'll come back to it in a moment, but I'll explain how we do that in practice. But this now is a two-dimensional trap in which we can confine atoms. And what we have shown, and also the group of Nir Davidson at Weizmann Institute, is that this is a new paradigm for chaos and quantum chaos. And it also is interesting from the standpoint of mixing and phase space. And we published a paper, and also Davidson's group published a paper last year, or this year, rather. So how do we make these optical billiards? This is one way. It's not the only way. It's the way we've done it up till now. There are other approaches that we are pursuing. The way we did it in these experiments is we generated this pattern dynamically. We took a laser beam, and it went through a device called an acousto-optic deflector. The acousto-optic deflector deflects the beam in a certain direction depending on the applied frequency of RF. And so by changing that frequency, we can just change that deflection angle. So we have one oriented for vertical deflection followed by another one for horizontal. And in this case, we draw out a circle. Now, if I draw out a circle and I do it slowly, you can see that it's a time-varying potential or time-varying light pattern. But if I do it fast enough, of course, not a very good circle now, but you can't probably, at least I can't resolve this anymore. And the idea is that if we do it fast enough, perhaps we can trick the atoms and make them think that they're seeing a time average potential. Now, because it's tuned to the blue of resonance, and if they're stuck inside, when they hit that wall, they should be reflected. Now, a circle is not a particularly interesting case because it's integrable, but we can make arbitrary patterns using arbitrary waveform generators that control these acousto-optic deflectors, and we can make any pattern we want. And people probably have seen this, so they're getting tired of it, but maybe this audience hasn't. This is an arbitrary pattern that we can create. We can make any billiard shape that we want. We can make multiply connected billiards. We can make billiards with holes in them. Really, it's a designer's paradise. So the question is, what is interesting, and what do we start with? So to see if this any of this made sense, if we could really correlate the motion with the shape of the billiard, we decided to start with something simple, not with something like this, although it has good PR value. We decided to start with a billiard that is just a wedge. And gravity is pointing downwards, as shown. And we do that like Zorro, you know, back and forth. Now, you might notice that there's some variation in the intensity. And since this picture was taken, we've actually corrected that. That has to do with the fact that the diffraction efficiency of this acousto-optic changes with frequency. But by compensating for that, we've actually made it uniform. Now, the idea is quite simple. Let's put atoms here, load them in. They're cold atoms. They're going to sit in this funnel. And we're going to ask, how do they move? The question is, how are we going to see that? Now, because we really can't look at individual trajectories. So what we decide to do is poke a hole at the bottom. Make it a funnel with a hole. And so, and the scale is shown here. So first of all, I should point out that these billiards are not hard wall billiards. They have some softness to them. And the softness is due to the fact that these are focused laser beams. But we can still talk about it as a billiard and analyze it. We open a hole, in this case, 50 micron hole. We load atoms here, and they bounce around. And if they are unlucky, they find the hole and leave. And these are cesium atoms, drawn not to scale. So we're going to put atoms here and see how they leak out. So one of my colleagues called this atomic clock, because it's like a sand clock. You load atoms in, and they dribble out. Question, but as I'll show you, this is actually a terrible clock, because the time is, as it's measured, depends critically on the angle of this wedge. Yeah. We've actually varied the scan rate. We've gone up to about 10 kilohertz. We find above about 5 kilohertz, the results are independent of the scan rate, which confirms, at least at the level that we've doing so far, that there's no that they are seeing a time average potential. So, all right, so what do we observe? Well, how do we do the experiment? Just very schematically, in this work, we use laser cooling and trapping of cesium atoms. We collect about 10 to the 6 cesium atoms in a magneto-optic trap, shown schematically here. It's in a vacuum chamber with six beams and magnetic field coils. Atoms are cooled to about 10 microkelvin. We put them in this funnel, and we let them bounce around for a fairly long time, about half a second. That corresponds to 25 bounces. We then measure the number of survivors, the fraction of that survive that don't find the hole after that time. And we measure the fluorescence, so we get a count rate. Now, we do that as a function of the wedge angle. We find something like this. And this was very reproducible. This is a survival probability as a function of the wedge half angle. And we scanned out from 20 degrees out to beyond 45 degrees. And we see oscillations. So the question is, what does that do to? So the oscillations mean that at certain angles, atoms are hanging around longer. This is half a second of storage time. Some atoms just didn't find the holes here, whereas at certainly beyond 45 degrees, essentially all the atoms find the hole very efficiently. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on is the fact that the dynamics in this wedge depend only on one parameter. There's only one free parameter here, and that's the wedge angle. But you can see, and I won't go through the details of phase space here, so just concentrate for the moment on the lower pictures, because they give you a visual picture of what's going on, is that for certain angles, like in this case 2 theta of 53 degrees, you have mixed phase space. What that means is that there are certain trajectories which are periodic and stable, as shown here. Whereas other trajectories that start out with some other initial condition exhibit chaos. Now, it's clear that the ones that exhibit chaos will find the hole quite efficiently. After a few bounces, they'll be out. On the other hand, something like this would never know, right, that there's a hole there. It just couldn't know about it. What happens is, as we open up the angle, we find that, for example, at 120 degrees, there are no stable structures anymore. Wherever you start in this wedge, you will undergo chaotic motion and find the building. That is why there are no atoms left. But we can do even better than that, and, well, we've done an analysis of this and a Monte Carlo simulation, and this is a classical Monte Carlo simulation with no adjustable parameters except for one, which I'll come to in a moment, only one adjustable parameter. But the scale of the angle is not adjusted, and we see that is following quite well the classical prediction. Now, what is happening, we can correlate that with the phase space, is that at these dips, the phase space becomes mostly chaotic, and beyond here, beyond 45 degrees, it becomes totally chaotic. At those points, atoms are not left because they find the hole. On the other hand, there are recurrences of stability, and you can actually predict them. They are at 90 over 4, which is 22.5 degrees, 90 over 3, 30 degrees, 90 over 2, something funny happens, which we understand, and that has to do with the fact that even though it's stable, the stable trajectories connect to the vertex, so they'll lead you right out, even though it's not chaotic. And that's why atoms are hanging around. Now, there is some problem here which illustrates where we're going with these type of experiments. The problem is that the agreement on the horizontal axis is fine, but we had to scale the vertical axis, the absolute survival probability, by a factor of 2 to agree with the experiment. And we think what is going on, there's negligible spontaneous scattering during this time, because we're so far detuned from resonance. So we think what is going on is primarily collisions. On a time scale of half a second, there could be a few collisions, and the collisions can knock atoms out of periodic orbits and possibly allow them to find the holes. This is not confirmed, and to do this, to really check this carefully, what we'd have to do is we'd have to somehow control the density, increase the collisions, or perhaps tune the collision cross-section by, for example, tuning magnetic field to a Feshbach resonance. We'd like to do that, but it does indicate some things about this system, which is, what is the role of particle interactions? And also, you might ask, where's quantum mechanics? Because I told you about ultra-cold atoms and quantum effects, yet everything here is described perfectly by classical physics. And the answer is given here by the scale. If you notice, the scale of this wedge, of this billiard that we made, is about a few hundred microns in size. The hole size is 50 microns. Our atoms are at 10 microkelvin, which gives them a de Broglie wavelength of about less than 100 nanometers. So we have a factor of 1,000 smaller in de Broglie wavelength compared to the typical scale of this billiard. That's why it's not surprising that we are in a classical regime. But where we're going with that, the next step will be to make smaller billiards. And I think for various reasons, it was hard for us in the current chamber to make very small billiards because of the distance that we had to go. But in the next generation chamber that we're building now, we should be able to shrink the billiard down to at least a factor of 10 or 20 smaller. So we would have 10, 20 or 30 micron size billiards. And we can go to much colder atoms. In fact, we can go to condensed atoms, which we are doing with rubidium and with sodium. In that case, we can get de Broglie wavelengths in the range of 5 to 10 microns. That will allow us to study the dynamics of billiards in the quantum regime as a first step. But I think what's even more exciting to me is that we can increase the interaction strength and start out with a condensate in these geometries and study the effects of many-body interactions in such billiards. And because of the control of the shape, both in space and in time, I think they're going to be very useful and interesting subjects. Just to give you a taste of what I think is interesting, if you just compare the problem that I talked about, which is essentially a classical problem of how particles leak out of a hole when they're independent, the problem becomes quite different when you have a strongly coupled gas in which there's repulsive interactions, so there's a lot of mean field energy that wants to explode. Now, if you open a hole suddenly, you could, and you're in a strong, in a hydrodynamic regime, you will get perhaps even supersonic flow out of this hole as the atoms rush out. And the question is, how does that affect what's left behind? So this is, becomes an interesting dynamic problem, many-body dynamic problem. So I think we can get into some interesting physics here. Well, the typical densities of condensates are around 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14. I mean, you can make it lower, but I think the challenge will be to go to higher densities. But the advantage here is that the coupling, which coupling? Between the atoms, it's between the atoms. That's right. Well, that's something we presumably we'd like to control. I mean, for example, we could start out with some density and then adiabatically shrink this whole thing to try and compress it. Now, at some point, we may see losses, and that's what people have been finding, is that at least in three dimensions, in magnetic traps, they find large losses. But perhaps we can avoid some of those, at least in an optical trap, by going to the right transition. That remains to be seen. How high, how far can we push the hydrodynamic limit with such atoms? All right, the second topic that I want to talk about is the is an example of the kind of thing that I envision as being many-body quantum control. So the idea would be to use some feature, the many-body physics, to do something that otherwise we wouldn't know how to do. And the example that I'll give here is to make a tweezer for atoms. That is quantum. When I say quantum, I mean that a tweezer that can extract a definite number of atoms in a trap, in a little microtrap, and furthermore, that those atoms be in the ground state of that trap. And that, to my knowledge, is something we don't know how to do with any other method. I mean, there's other ways of achieving single atoms in traps, but they all involve, to my knowledge, some degree of indeterminacy, whereas this, the method we propose, is completely deterministic, and it also produces them automatically in the ground state of the trap, which is another virtue. And it could, and you could do it not just with one, but we find two and three and perhaps more. Why could this be interesting? Well, it could be interesting, and I'm just throwing these out. We don't know yet, but these are possible applications. If you could extract and assemble arrays of atoms, at least you'd have one step. At least something that people have talked about doing with neutral atoms, the kind of control that people have currently over ions, to have that with neutral atoms. You could really manipulate one at a time deterministically and know that you have one at a time. It could be important for atom interferometry or for many-body atom interferometry. And we're even thinking about possible mesoscopic mass standards. So the theory behind this is done with Chen Yu and his student Roberto Diener. I should point out, Chen Yu was a postdoc here maybe 10 or more years ago. I don't know if there's anyone who remembers him. He worked with Walter Cohen, and now he's a professor in Austin, condensed matter theorist. We work together very closely. And the basic idea that we came up with is to consider coupling a quantum dot, and this could be of light, but it doesn't have to be light. It could be a quantum dot, a magnetic quantum dot. The idea is to couple a quantum dot to a Bose condensate. So this would be like putting a dimple or a defect in a condensate. That would create a local minima inside this whole thing, and atoms will accumulate there. But then what we'd want to do is we take that dimple and extract it at some velocity v. So we just pull it out of the condensate. What do we find? Well, here's now it depends, what we find depends critically on the extraction velocity. So the three panels here show what we get at different stages of extraction. So this is within the condensate, this is kind of as we're coming out, and this is as we leave. Well, this is nothing very good, right? We start out with some distribution, we sweep it out, and we get a mess. But we're doing it rather fast, 10,000 millimeters per second. That's too fast, turns out. So let's go slower. Well, we go at 100 millimeters per second, and we start out with a distribution, and we find at the end of the game, once we've separated from the condensate, we've got, I should say the horizontal scale is the number of atoms in the state. Now, they're all in the ground state, but when I say two atoms, I mean the two-body, two-atom ground state. So we're talking about all ground states, but there's a one-atom ground state, two-atom ground state, three-atom ground, and so on. So in this case, we ended up with something which shares a partial probability to be in the one-atom ground state, but also the two-atom. But then, when we go even slower, something miraculous happens, and we end up with exactly one atom. Now, if we go even slower, much slower, we find that we don't extract anything. It comes out empty. So we pull our thing out, and if it's too slow, it's empty. So what's going on? Well, first of all, you might ask, well, how robust is this? Is this going to be a very sensitive process? The magic is all happening as we're exiting the condensate. So it's not happening inside the condensate. It's actually as we're exiting, we're decoupling. Something is happening. And in fact, we can plot the probability of extracting a single atom as a function of speed in millimeters per second. And we see that there's a broad range. Well, this is the regime where I started out. The probability was very low. In fact, it was a mess. And at 100, we were getting better, but still not there. But once we go slow enough, the fidelity is as good as you want it. I mean, we found incredibly high fidelity, which means with very high probability we can do that. Now, if you go much slower, you find this tails off again, and that is, so in the end, if you are ultimately too slow, you find that you don't extract anything. So what is going on? Roughly speaking, what we're doing is you can understand what we're doing in terms of Landau-Zener transitions between the different states. So the uncoupled system, if you look in the way out of the condensate, you can associate the different states have different energies. So this would be the zero atoms in the little microtrap, one atom, two atoms, three atoms. But because of the coupling between this quantum dot, this defect, and the condensate, you get avoided crossings. And these avoided crossings get smaller and smaller as you go further out, because the coupling gets weaker and weaker. So eventually, when you get far enough away from the condensate, the coupling goes to zero. Now what's happening is that at certain velocities, we are slow enough so that we are remaining adiabatic. So we're following, in this case, we're going from a state that was two atoms into one atom. But notice that this band gap is big enough. This one is so small that we are not adiabatic, that we actually, with very high likelihood, make a Landau-Zener transition and jump to this state. And we extract on the one state. Now, why is this so robust? This is robust because we're using a Landau-Zener process which is exponentially sensitive to the band gap. So we can engineer this in such a way that we can be adiabatic with very high probability on one band gap, but non-adiabatic with very high probability on the other. So whenever you have a process that's exponentially sensitive, you have the possibility of being very high discrimination. Now, I didn't bring here other cases which we've analyzed. We're writing this up for publication. But we've also shown that we can extract deterministically at different velocities and not necessarily under the same parameters. We can extract two, and we've gone up to three. We think it can be done with higher number, but we haven't shown that. In fact, you can see in some cases, and I again don't have this here, a stair step of quantized extraction, that if you just scan the velocity, you find one, exactly one, then it goes up to two and three. But it turns out if we want to optimize the fidelity for any one case, we probably need to optimize it for that case it's hard to achieve high fidelity on all the extractions. So if you really want to get one, we know how to do it. If you want to get two, we know how to do it, but you may want to change the parameters a little bit to adjust for that. Now, this is really a first step in quantum control, and it's a completely different mechanism than anything we've seen before. It really relies on many-body Landau-Zener tunneling, but that also what makes it so sensitive, so robust rather. It's robust in the right regime if we adjust the regime. On the other hand, it's the simplest thing we could think of doing. I mean, in the sense that we took a trap that was harmonic, and we extracted it at some constant velocity. Now, one could imagine doing a more sophisticated type of control because, you know, coupling the first part of my talk to think about these billiards, by adjusting the shape of the billiard, we could engineer the shape of the condensate. And then by adjusting the velocity profile, we could really optimize this. It's not clear that, you know, that a constant velocity is the best thing to do. One could think of some acceleration or some time-varying velocity. So there's certainly a lot more things that can be optimized, but I think it's, for us, this was very encouraging that we could do something with such high determinacy, and the fact that it comes out in the ground state. The next part of my talk deals with something, you know, as they say, and now for something completely different. So how the hell do we get into this? This actually, funny enough, grew out of a talk where I was in the talk with Joseph Case, who's a biophysicist in my department. And it actually was, funny enough, was a direct offshoot of the work we did on billiards. So we heard a talk about, I think the talk was about patterning neurons by making little scratches on surfaces and forcing them to grow. And it was fairly evident from the talk they don't like to do that. So we were thinking, could there be a better way? And that sort of led us to the intuition that, and the general intuition is that suppose you have a process that is diffusion limited, some random process. Perhaps you could use optical dipole forces to provide a bias. And you may not need a lot. You might just need to give some preferential direction, and that might be enough to help things along, to sort of flip the coin in the right direction. And this is quite different, I think, than the concept of optical tweezers. Optical tweezers, as I said, go back to 1970 from Art Ashkin and have been an important, increasingly important tool in biology. But optical tweezers are really to use force. I mean, you just use intensities laser powers of watts focused to a few microns, and you can physically pick things up and move them around. So you can do that on cells and other objects. But it's not influencing a biological process. It's using force to just shove things around. Our approach was to ask, could we more naturally just assist growth? And the possible applications of this, which are still we're pursuing and just starting to pursue really, are towards possibly constructing neural networks by growing them with our light patterns. Using this more generally, not just neurons, this concept could be used for cell growth, any growth process. Moreover, it doesn't even have to be a biological growth process. This could be some pattern formation, like a polymer growth or a crystal growth, where there's, again, some unbiased growth. You could perhaps bias it. These have not been done yet. And finally, if you want to really be scary, you could think, my colleague Joseph Case is into this, I'm probably going to stay away because that, you know, involves blood and all kinds of things. But in vivo applications. So how does this work? Well, roughly speaking, so we set out to do this about 8 months ago, and we used existing equipment. We put together a Ti Sapphire system, 800 nanometers, that was to avoid resonances in water. And we set this up on a confocal Zeiss microscope. We wanted to automate the scanning, so we adapted an atomic force microscope platform that allows us to scan 100 by 100 microns, computer controlled. So we were able to place to culture these neurons, and the different neurons were used, PC12 and NG108, and unfortunately there are a few neuroscientists in the audience who might ask me embarrassing questions, but I'm not sure if I can answer all of them because I've not been the main person doing this culturing, but I could perhaps answer a few. But the idea is that, so here's a physicist picture of a neuron. It has a, and please feel free to correct me if I'm saying something foolish, but there's a growth cone at the end and an axon, and we focus light at the end, which is called lamapodium, and we try to guide it from that point on. Now, we started out by automating this, we actually started out by not being too particular where we start the scan. We found that if we actually put the laser inside, it inhibits growth. But if we put it right at the leading edge and then guide it out, then it likes to grow. And the first experiment started well inside, but we then went to here. And then along the sort of same spirit of the billiards, we decided to dynamically scan it. Now, the billiard problem, we had the atoms standing still, or, well, in free fall, but we were suspending them, and we were drawing a light pattern around them. Here we're kind of doing the opposite. We have a microscope in which we have a focused laser beam, and we have the cells in this AFM stage, and we're moving them underneath the light. Now, because the time scale is so much longer, the typical time for this growth may take between half an hour to a few hours, which it seems like there's a conservation law of how long it takes to do experiments. In the cold atom work, we take a year to set it up, and then it takes minutes to take the data sometimes. Here, it didn't take minutes to set it up, but it took relatively short time to set it up, but then a year to do the experiments, because we could only do experiments on one neuron at a time, and each one lasted several hours. So this is somewhat painful, but we're getting to the point now of automating this, so I hope we can multiplex this and do this faster. So we moved this under the laser light, and we found that if we raster it back and forth, we can actually match the light pattern to the shape of that particular neuron, and then it grows much better. So here's some pictures, and I apologize for not, this would actually be best shown on movies, but I didn't really plan to show this. In fact, this is the first time I kind of show it in public, and we're again about to submit this maybe next week as soon as we can write this up for publication. This shows on PC12, these are rat neurons genetically engineered to grow faster. This was mixed here. The green and the blue are reversed. So the green is the initially. So what we do is we focus in on some neuron on the microscope. We can visualize it at the same time from one direction. In the other direction, we have the laser beam controlling it, and the laser spot is shown. I don't know if you can see it. It's that bright dot there. Okay. We observe it for some time just to make sure that it's healthy and growing nicely and happy and everything else. Of course, this is a growing system, so it is being fed and taken care of and groomed and so forth. We see that it's growing out in a certain direction, shown by the green arrow. We then decide, no, you're not going to do that. So we're going to force it to grow downwards. And so we start taking this point, and for reference, we show this red line here. That's a constant reference point. On this picture, it's underneath the scale. And we start guiding it. And this shows a time exposure, 22 minutes and 50 minutes. It's growing downwards, and it reaches this point. And at that point, after 80 minutes, we say, okay, we've had enough of that. Let's turn right, right turn rudder, whatever. And so we guide it for some more. And after some time, it stops growing. Now, we've had this problem, which we, this is something really for the neuroscientist to help us with, the experimentalist. Why does it retract and why does it stop growing? When it doesn't want to grow, it seems like nothing we can do will change that. But when it is in a growing mode, we can direct its growth. So we have grown it out as much as 100 microns. This is, by the way, is done with 100 milliwatts focused to 3 microns. We've done this with tens of milliwatts. To give you an idea, that's about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude less intensity than optical tweezers. So there's no tweezing here. I mean, we really are, at these intensities, we are not forcing anything around. We are just providing a guide. Here's more examples. This is done on another example where we observe that it grows out in this direction, green line, and we decide we're going to go to this direction, and we guide it for some time. This is after 30 minutes. We've grown it out. Again, there seems to be limits to how much we can do, but it is very reproducible in the sense that the success rate seems high if it's growing. Now, there are limits also to what kind of angles we can do, and we're in the process of trying to understand. We can't make it take a sudden 90-degree turn. I mean, there are limits to what we can do. We've guided other, this is another neuron, NG108, and Here, a little harder to see because the growth rate is slower, but nevertheless, it wants to grow out. It's growing out in this direction, and we try to guide it out. And we have been successful in guiding it in the upward direction. So one aspect of this is guiding. The other is enhanced growth. And enhanced growth is perhaps a little trickier. Yes?
Can you explain again how you're doing the guiding? Are you dithering the beam about the growth axis?
No, what we're doing is we are dithering transverse to the growth direction to broaden it out to match to the growth cone. Then it's a little embarrassing, but we wrote a very sophisticated program to automate this, and what we found was that the automation didn't work very well, and we determined why. It was interesting in its own right. We had pre-programmed a path, so we said we're going to go along this path. And it's important to do that because you want to be sure that you're not biasing in any way, that the human hand is not the one that's determining how this grows. But what we found is that when we had a pre-programmed in pattern, it always went back to the same point. And as the thing was growing, even though we started out at the leading edge, eventually we found ourselves coming back deep inside the growth cone, and it caused it to stop growing. So what we found is that what is necessary is a more sophisticated program which will actually do some sort of automatic edge detection, which will identify and change the program dynamically to follow that. And we're in the process of doing that now. So most of these are actually done manually. But they're manual in the sense that we make sure that we don't put a bias because we have a predetermined path that we take. And that path is not just, you know, the user feels like doing that. We decide in advance how we're going to go, and then we follow that path. The question of accelerated growth is a little more delicate because these are living objects. Their growth rate changes spontaneously for reasons that we don't understand. We're just looking at these neurons. They grow for some time, and they have big growth spurts, and then they stop, and then they rest for some time, and then they start growing again for some unknown reason. So I would say at this point, we are accumulating evidence. We think it's getting stronger, but it's still, this is the one thing that I'm not as sure about, is the accelerated growth. But you can see it here, and we have circumstantial evidence we're hoping to solidify. But this shows the case of two neurons close to, or two axons with the growth cones close to each other, and we take this one and try and pull it out. And you can see here, after 42 minutes, it's leading. After that time, the other one is down here. I should have shown it, but it's way behind. And after 66 minutes, it's way behind. So in every time that we've tried, it looks like we are enhancing growth, but that remains to be quantified. So again, this is a starting point. I think for us it's very exciting because this is really a new kind of tool, and I think could lead to a lot of interesting physics and science in general. So I think I'll end here. I won't get into the beam slowing, which is a whole story in its own right. And I'll just like to thank and acknowledge the members of my group who worked on the cold atom experiments, the collaboration with Chen Yu and his student Roberto Diener, condensed matter theory, collaboration with my colleague Manfred Fink and students who are working on molecular beam slowing, which I did not talk about, and Joseph Case and his group in biophysics. And thank you for your attention. No.
Well, you've got milliwatts in micrometers. But whatever it is there any
effect on that?
Are you boiling these neurons?
No. Well, people do. In fact, Joseph Case, my colleague, does tweezing with watts focused to microns. So that's why I said that we're about 1,000 times smaller than typical optical tweezers. And because we're at 800 nanometers, there seems to be no effect of the light. Just broad illumination doesn't seem to interfere with them at all. No.
If it's not tweezing, why are the neurons following the light?
That's the big question, right? Our conjecture is that it's causing preferred polymerization of actin, that it's drawing in, that it is dipole force, and it's drawing in the actin to polymerize along that direction, and that is what is causing it to grow. But that's not, all I can say is that it works, right? That was our intuition, and that seems to be what's happening. We're working in parallel on experiments where we, I would say these are straight polymer experiments where we just take actin filaments and try and polymerize them in a controlled direction. So we're in the process of doing that. I think that would be probably pretty conclusive, and we have some preliminary evidence that works. Of course, this is a living system, so it's hard to say exactly what's going on. But that was at least that's what got us into it. What is the motivation for doing that? Well, for one thing, you could imagine taking neurons and if you could really control their growth patterns, you could connect them up and make a neural network on a slide where you could control the connections. That's the dream. I don't know yet because we haven't. I have to be careful. We haven't done that yet. We haven't even taken two neurons and connected them. So all we've done so far is taken one and guided it. But that would be one goal. The other goal, I think more generally, this is about using dipole forces to control polymerization of a soft condensed matter system. That's a new idea as far as we know. And in fact, that might be an interesting, I think from just because this is ITP, I should say that I think this is an interesting problem in soft condensed matter physics to understand how a dipole force like that could aid polymerization, because I'm not aware that has been calculated. Don't ask me. There are people here who could answer that far better than me. Perhaps they want to comment, David?
There's nothing deep to say. The promiscuousness of the neurons at certain stages in culture and making connections when the one cell's process causes another cell's process. Some of this is aided by some molecules. But we may wonder everything.
Well, it would be very useful to form networks in culture and define ways to study the dynamics of
Your quantum dot would be a focused laser beam.
Yeah.
And so, right. To what degree is the ability to track multiple atoms in a given spot determined by the tuning and intensity of the light so that you don't have photo association or other kinds of collision processes that are going to limit? How much of that's included in these?
We have not done calculations of photo association, but I'm assuming that these are far enough detuned from any molecule. I mean, in the same sense that you can make a condensate in an optical trap. We're not achieving, we're not going for particularly high densities.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, I'd be worried if the densities were particularly high compared to the condensate, but they're not. The geometry is such that it's essentially a 1D. It's very soft in one direction and very tightly coupled in the other two, so that the quantum dot is typically the numbers. I didn't tell you the numbers, but typically a few microns, maybe 3 to 5 microns focused spot in an elongated geometry. It's a few recoils deep, I believe. Yeah,
I wonder if you have local heating back to
that's the question.
In which system?
Enhancing diffusion and therefore all the ingredients that takes place to build this neuron are enhanced.
It's possible, but one thing. I mean, we've seen several things that indicate that it's not. First of all, the intensities are quite small, but also by changing the raster size, we can really control the width of the growth. That is, if we scan 2 microns, it grows 2 microns wide. If we scan 5 microns, it grows 5 microns wide. So we have very precise control by the raster, and it's hard to imagine any heating effect which is going to be localized. Remember, the timescales here are half an hour to an hour, that any heating would in a water environment that's temperature, this whole system is temperature controlled, by the way, that local heating could be localized to 1 micron, I doubt it. I'd be very surprised. But we can't rule that out entirely, but I don't think so. I mean, I don't know how to... If anyone has a suggestion how we could definitively answer that.
Can I get the pen here? I mean, you'd be right about your estimates. For power intensities up to about 10 to the 11 watts per centimeter squared, you know, even if you go to intensities with molecules loaded into single cells for absorbing, and you're pretty well, there's some molecules, like some electro-stress molecules called flavors that absorb, have two photon absorption, you can't pop that around to be able to do that anymore. The strong absorbers are your half the strong absorbers, you got it about 750, but even purposely loading your own molecules, right? And just looking at the electrical properties of the cell, shining on power supply to 10 to the 11, you do not appreciably change these properties, and it's light on, light off, light on, light off. Okay, I'm not, I mean, that there is some uncertainty in the literature about high intensity.
Our intensities, by the way, are about 10 to the 10 watts per square meter. So it's 10 to the 6, we're like 10 to the 6 watts per square centimeter. So we're down by 6, you know, 5 or 6 orders of magnitude compared to that limit. So these are really low intensities. Yeah.
Can you play with detreating versus intensity?
In which case?
Versus the magnitude of the dipole?
For the neurons or for the?
For the neurons.
No, we haven't. We've tuned the Thai Sapphire to about 800 nanometers, and there's a broad window over which you can tune it just to minimize absorption in the water. We haven't really played with that much, but I don't expect that to be a very sensitive parameter as long as we're within that window. Of light.
Yeah, seeing if it correlates to
the are you polarized at all? I'm sorry? It is polarized. It's just going through a so long optical path that I don't remember, and it's coming down, you know, it's being deflected. It's coming up actually. Yeah, it's also being focused so tightly that I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. That's something we could check.
Yeah. In the final stadium, you measure how many particles remain.
Right.
How do you know that someone is taking over
the stadium? Okay. Good question. We first compare that with the same funnel in which we close it off at the bottom.
So you have this very neat single atom source that pulls out atoms around it. It seems that if you could pull out an atom that was not in the ground state, then you might be able to turn that into a very reliable single photon source by pulling out an atom that would quickly decay if you pulled out in the excited state, which would be a very interesting thing. to quantum computing people. You can have a reliable single photon source.
Well, we have the presider has made a reliable single photon source. The excited state, though, this is an emotional state. So remember that the frequencies of these traps are kilohertz. So it wouldn't it's a neutral particle also. So I don't see how that would work. But he has made a very reliable single photon source.
Thank you.